originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I would like to thank everyone listening to us here on Sirius 219, XM 206, and also to those of you listening to our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries such as paralysis and brain damage, so please visit their website if you are able to help. That's www.pdjf.org. So this evening, we will be joined by a rider who has not one, not two, but currently 9 riding titles to his name from racetracks all over the country. He found great success at the graded stakes level with the champion gelding Poor But Honest. He won his 2,000th victory at Tampa in 2016. He has a total of 2,131 victories to be exact and over $34 million in earnings. It is a pleasure to introduce jockey Dean Butler. Dean, welcome to the show.
Hi, great to be on. Thank you.
Dean, so excited to hear your story. And you're just recently coming back from a pretty serious injury. I heard that you had a serious spill there at Canterbury in July. How are you feeling from that?
I'm doing pretty good, actually. Feeling really good, actually. I fractured 3 vertebrae in my back, and then when I was in the emergency room, and they kept asking me if I had passed out or got knocked out or whatever, and I said no. I said, just trust me, I know when I hit the ground if I pass out. I said, because I've had 9 previous concussions, and the doctor said, scan his head too. So they scanned my head and actually found a basilar tip aneurysm in the base of my brain.
Wow. Thank God they found that.
Yeah. You're right. Exactly. Thank God is right. Because if I don't hit the ground, I never know I have it.
Blessing in disguise, Dean. Seriously.
Yeah.
What do they do to fix a brain aneurysm?
What they did was they went in through the main artery down by my groin, and they went up through my heart and into the artery. And what they did was they coiled it. And when I say coil, what they have, like, it's like spaghetti, like angel hair pasta, metal, and it's metal. It's real flexible. And what they do is they fill that aneurysm, they put those coils in there, and then they what they ended up doing was putting a stent over the mouth of the aneurysm so those coils that they put in didn't fall out.
Sounds pretty complex to me, Dean. That's that's crazy. So how long did it take you to recover from not just the broken vertebrae but from that surgery as well?
Actually, I went in on a Wednesday morning, and I was out Thursday afternoon from it. And actually, I was awake for the whole procedure. And then actually 2 days later, I was driving from Minnesota to Nashville to my brother's house.
2 days later.
Yeah.
Joggy's definitely We're a crazy bunch, Dean. I can tell you that for sure. How soon after that were you getting on horses?
I didn't start getting on because I got on horses like the second week in November because I was on a Plavix, which is a blood thinner from that procedure, and they didn't want me on horses until I was off of that, and I had to be on that for like 6 to 8 weeks after the procedure was done.
That makes sense, and I'm sure this is something you've had to go through quite frequently in your career. I remember reading, I think you also had a pretty serious spill at Monmouth. So tell us, how many, Dean, do you know how many bones you've broken?
Well, I've fractured the 3 vertebrae in my brain. I've had 9 concussions. I broke my tibia and my fibula and my leg. And I had a lot of compressed fractures in my back from the spill that you were talking about at Monmouth. Actually, when they came and got me on the racetrack, I was actually not breathing, and they had to revive me. And then when we were pulling up the emergency room doors at Monmouth, I went down. I crashed again, and then they intubated me, and I was on a respirator for 4 days in the hospital after that.
You're lucky to be alive after that.
Yeah, you know, one thing about it, the good Lord upstairs has been looking out for me, that's for sure.
I would say so. So throughout all your injuries, and obviously we'll get to the highlights of your career too, but going through all of these serious spills and comebacks, do you ever think, why am I doing this? Do you have any doubts?
No. And the day that I do is the day that I'll stop riding.
Yeah.
Because of the fact that, you know, if you're out there and you're scared or, you know, then you don't need to be out there because you're going to end up getting yourself hurt or somebody else.
That's exactly right. So what is it that keeps you coming back for more?
Well, I've always wanted to be a jockey since I was about 5 years old. I grew up in Saratoga Springs, New York, so the racetrack was a mile and a half, 2 miles from my house. So, and I just, very fortunate. I was very small. I was light and kind of had the build for a jockey. And I was able, you know, I was very fortunate to be able to do my dream or what I always wanted to do.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. Let's focus on that. The beginning of your career. And you said you were 5 years old. What a place to grow up too. I mean, Saratoga, probably my favorite place in the entire world. But did you come from a family, a racetrack family?
Nope. Nobody in my family had anything to do with racehorses.
Really?
I was actually working in a bar when I was like 16, and I was working in the kitchen area, and a friend of my sister was a bartender there, came in, and she saw me, and she's like, "Hey, you ever thought about being a jockey?" And I said, "Yeah, ever since I was about 5 years old." I said, and she said, "Well, I can get you a job with the leading trainer in the country." And at that time, the leading trainer in the country was Jack Vanberg. Mm. And I ended up getting a job with him, and the rest is kind of history. He taught me a lot. I learned a lot underneath Jack, and basically taught me how to ride and do everything, I should say. And I learned from the bottom up. You know, I mean, I cleaned stalls, I built fences, and everything from the bottom up. You know, I didn't just go out and get on horses and start galloping and then get my jock's license. I learned a lot about a horse before I was even able to get on a horse.
Well, and that's the best way too, Dean. You see, some of these younger riders, they don't really learn from the ground up. They don't learn the very basics before they ride. Obviously, that's
right.
The best way. Learn more about the animal before you sit on their back.
You know, I mean, I've been riding almost 25 years, you know, and, you know, I can come back and tell a trainer something, but I've always been able to do that. I've always, even when I had the bug, you know, I'd come back and tell trainers, you know, if I felt something or whatever. And a lot of them would look at me like, you know, like they were, they were actually shocked that I could tell them, you know, that I felt something here or felt something there or whatever. And a lot of the younger kids, you know, they go and they get on horses and they start galloping, and next thing you know, they're riding races, but they can't tell you anything. You know, that's the sad part about it. You know, I mean, some of them need a little bit more schooling, should I say.
Well, and tell us how you go about doing that. Is that just from watching horses, maybe with injuries, coming back from injuries in the barn area when you were a groom or whatever, and focusing on how they looked, and then you could translate that to how they felt when you're on their back? Or tell us how you learned that.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate. I've been on great horses. I've been on, you know, horses that were sound. I've been on a lot of sore horses, you know. I mean, I used to breeze a lot of horses for Steve Asmussen. I mean, I breeze Curlin. I breeze Lady Tech. I breeze basically every good horse that he ever had in his barn. I was on their back, you know, and breezed them. And so, you know, I mean, I know what a good horse feels like. I knew what a sound horse felt like versus a sore horse. And, you know, and sometimes you can kind of tell where it's at. You might not be able to pinpoint it, but you could say, okay, you know, it may feel like he's off in his left, but it's actually he's compensating from his right. You know, his right is, you know, so he's putting more pressure on his left side than he is on his right side.
Jockey Dean Butler joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Dean, working for Jack Vanberg, did he know that you wanted to be a rider from the get-go?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, he knew I wanted to be a rider, but like, you know, he basically told me, he says, well, son, you're going to learn from the ground up first. You're going to learn everything about a horse first, you know, and I said, I'm glad that I did it that way. You know, I think it made me a better, rider as far as that's concerned, you know, understanding the horse a little bit more.
And you came from a large family, Dean. What did they think about your career choice?
Well, they always supported me. I mean, my mom and dad, they supported me. I mean, my dad's still alive. I mean, he's going to be 89 years old the day after Christmas, you know, and he's actually down here now in Florida with me.
Nice.
And, you know, it was funny because, like, my mom, she would never watch the races. She would always wait till they were she would always watch the replay, you know, and she'd always ask my dad, did he cross the wire? And, you know, is he okay? Yep. Okay, now I can watch the race. Otherwise, she really never watched the races live. You know, my dad always did. My dad always, he went to the races. He always went to simulcast and watched the races. And he always went to Saratoga, of course. But he even to this day, when he's not around where I'm riding, he's always on his phone watching the races.
Sounds like you had a great support system then.
And oh, yeah. Yep.
When did you feel like you were ready to actually start riding races?
Well, when I came back from, because I had gone out to California after I graduated from high school, and I came back, I was out there for about a year, and then I came back and I started galloping at Saratoga. I was actually in Saratoga galloping, and then I went to New York, and of course, as every young rider that's wanting to ride and all that, you always think, you know, when, oh yeah, I'm ready, you know. I mean, I could breeze, you know, 8, 10, 12, 15 horses in the morning, you know, and I'm like, oh, I'm ready, you know. And, but then when I rode my first race, I remember it was in New York, and I was like, holy cow, this is a little different. You know, because it's more, you know, mind-wise and all that kind of stuff, you know. You get more nervous, or you're so, I don't know, it's just, it's more draining on you than just breezing horses. And then, but I just felt that, you know, yeah, I'm ready, you know, I'm good. And then I rode like 5 races in New York, and I just wasn't quite ready, you know. I mean, I knew I needed more experience, and I wasn't going to get it there. So actually, that's when I left and I went to Suffolk Downs in Boston and started from there.
Suffolk Downs. Dean, I rode at Suffolk early on in my career as well. And is that where you really started to take off with your apprenticeship?
No, actually, I think I win 5 or 6 races up there, and that was where I win my first race. And I win like 5 or 6 races, and then a rider by the name of Joe Hampshire, he was up there, and I got to know Joe real well, and he was, he helped me a lot. And he was going back to Philadelphia, and he said, give me a couple of weeks, and I'll get you an agent, and you come down. He goes, because, you need to go someplace else. He goes, you got a lot of talent. And I'm like, okay. Well, it was about 2 or 3 weeks, and he called me up, and he says, well, pack your stuff, and come on down. I got you an agent. So I went down there, and that was when Juan Umana was the leading rider and the bug rider, and he had just lost his bugs. And the agent that I had, Terry Ames, he was real good friends with Mark Reed. And Mark Reed, of course, was the leading trainer at that time. And he said that, you'll ride for him. Well, heck, I was there probably 2 or 3 weeks, and I still hadn't met Mark Reed. Mm-hmm. And my agent said, he goes, well, you're not ready for him yet. And then he brought me by the barn, and then when I went by the barn and saw him, that's when I started riding all these horses, and it just took off from there. And just, Juan was probably 25 or 30 wins in front of me. And it took me about a month and a half, and I caught him and went by him. And that was when I won my first riding title.
Wow, that's incredible. I want to go back a little bit. You mentioned Joe Hampshire. We've had Joe here on the show as well, and one of my favorite people in the world. Joe's definitely, he was a great mentor to me as well. And did he take you under his wing when you were still young and learning?
Yeah, when I was in Boston, he helped me a lot. And then when I went to Philadelphia, he helped me a lot. And, of course, him and Tony Black were very good friends. And then when I came in and Joe was there riding and Tony was riding, of course, Tony used to be, the king of, Keystone, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, basically. And Tony helped me a lot, So I had two pretty good veteran riders that really, helped me and guided me and taught me a lot.
I would say so. I remember riding against Tony Black. You could not, he would ride every other horse in the race. You couldn't pass him. Forget about it. It wasn't happening.
Tony used to ride so long.
Yeah.
So when I used to ride with him, and I'd stay directly in behind him. Well, because Tony could never look between his legs. He was too, he was always riding so long. And I just sit right behind him, just wait. And then he had a kind of a patented move when he turned for home. He'd look to the outside and he'd look to the inside. And when he looked back to the outside, he'd drift out. And when he drift out, that's when usually I cut to the inside. And I prayed that I had enough horse to get in there and get by him, because within 2 jumps, he was going to be right on top of you, putting you on top of the fence.
That is exactly right. I'm glad you figured it out. I didn't figure out how to pass him. So good job.
Yeah, you had a. I mean, granted, don't get me wrong. I had the horse. It didn't matter if I went inside of him or outside of him. It didn't matter. I was going to probably beat him anyway. But he made you work, and he taught me a lot.
How would you describe the riding style that you developed? Would you say you were better on the front end, or would you prefer to come from off the pace, or were you pretty versatile?
A lot of people tell me that they love me on the lead, and because I do have a pretty good clock in my head, I can kind of tell how fast you're going, and how even if I'm coming from behind, I can read and basically know how fast everybody's going, and that's one good thing as far as a rider's standpoint. I mean, you go back to Jerry Bailey. I mean, Jerry, I think he had a good clock in his head, and he always had his horses in a good position, and that's half the battle. You just try and get them in a good position, keep them clear, and, me, I like to, it all depends. I mean, on the dirt, I'd like to go to the lead, or be close to it. because you kind of have to. But when it comes to the grass, I like to sit back and wait, you know, and try and determine the pace factor and go by that and see what, you know, where I should be or where my horse wants to be, I should say.
Well, and describe that to the audience, Dean, the difference, the main differences between riding on the grass and the dirt.
Well, riding on the dirt, you know, a lot of times the dirt is more speed favoring. You know, so you want to be forwardly placed. You want to be in the race and give your horse a chance. You know, I mean, and a lot of it depends on the style of the horse, too. I mean, you can't horse it. You go back to the old horse, you know, four go or whatever, you know, you couldn't put him on the lead and expect to carry, you know. I mean, it's just, I kind of adapt the way the horse wants to run. But, yeah, on the dirt, you know, it's more speed favoring, you know, and you know, it's a little harder to make up ground. But on the grass, you know, it's more patience. You know, you got to be real patient, and hopefully you can have your horse, you know, relaxed and comfortable enough to where he's not pulling on you, because the less that they pull on you and you're pulling on them, the more horse you're going to have underneath you, because then they're not exerting themselves, you know, more than they should. But and that's like on the dirt, you see horses win off by 10 or 12, you know, but on the grass, there are a lot more close finishes. I mean, you might see a horse turning for home. He might be five in front on the grass. Well, he runs dead last, because the last eighth of a mile, 16th of a mile, the cavalry's coming. You know, I mean, there are a lot closer finishes on the turf versus the dirt.
Speaking of grass, Dean, I read that you won one of your many riding titles at Atlantic City. And that also brings back memories to me, riding there. And what a cool place that is. And that place has such a beautiful turf course.
Oh, yeah. I loved it. I mean, it was the best. I mean, it could torrential downpour, and the grass course was actually better when it was wetter than when it was dry, you know. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, I loved it because you just sit on the fence. I used to just sit on the fence and wait and wait and wait. And the turns are kind of tight on the grass, and them riders would go to asking their horses going into the turn and start. Well, naturally, when the horse picks it up, I mean, he's going to drift out a little bit, and they'd always come off the fence, and I'd just stay on the fence and just, you know, again, granted, I had tons of horse. It didn't matter if I went around or if I stayed inside, you know, but I could wait a lot longer and sit inside because I had so much horse, you know. You know, I always go back to my old saying is, you know, it's 95% horse, 5% rider, and when that 5% comes in, that's when the rider messes up and gets the horse beat. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think if you're on the best horse, you're going to win no matter what.
Dean, tell us about the turnout at Atlantic City. And granted, when I was riding there, it was a pretty short meet, but it would just bring the crowds out like you wouldn't believe. And was it the same back in the day when you rode there? And what do you think other racetracks can do to get that kind of crowd to come out and enjoy the races?
Well, you know, I mean, back when I was in Atlantic City, yeah, the crowd used to come out. And, like, and I mean, I go to Minnesota in the summertime, and it's Canterbury Park. And, I mean, there's 6,000-7,000 people there every night. They come out, you know. But, you know, and, you know, I just think that, you know, as far as what the racetracks can do, you know, I really don't know. I don't know. I guess would probably make it, like, as far as Canterbury is concerned, it's more of a family-oriented type of place, you know, because when people come to the races, you know, sometimes they want to have their kids, sometimes they don't want to have their kids. And, you know, so, you know, it all depends. I don't know what they could do. You know, I mean, I think since simulcasting and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, wagering online and all that, I think that's kind of hurt us a little bit, you know, as far as that's concerned.
Well, it is sad, Dean. You know, thinking back at Suffolk, you know, it's they hardly run there anymore. And do they still run any days at Atlantic City?
That I don't know. I haven't been there and for so long, you know. I mean the last time I was in New Jersey was 02, I think. Yeah, 02.
But anyway, Dean, just a couple minutes here before we go to break. But let's go back to your success in Pennsylvania. You teamed up there with Mark Reed and found great success there. How long did you stay in Pennsylvania in that mid-Atlantic area?
I was there actually pretty much exactly to the day a year. Like I said, the first riding title I win when I first came in there, and then I just followed. And then the last one was the spring and summer meet or winter spring meet, I think it was called, or whatever. Actually, me and Tony Black tied for leading rider that last meet.
Wow, that's impressive.
So that was kind of an honor, you know. And then I had lost the bug. I'd been riding about a month and a half or so, almost 2 months without the bug. So, you know, but I had had a sizable lead to where I was comfortable. But Tony, it was came down. Then I ended up getting days the last week, and I was leaving anyway. I was going to Monmouth, and everybody thought I was nuts going to Monmouth. And I said, well, you know what? I can always come back here if I don't do any good. I want to go try Monmouth Park and see what that brings me, you know. And so the last week that I was there, that's when Tony ended up tying me in the standings.
Wow. So you didn't really struggle then immediately after you lost your bug.
No, I didn't. And, when I went to Monmouth Park, you know, I mean, I ended up riding for Jimmy Krupe, and I ended up finishing, I think I was ninth in the standings the first year I was at Monmouth.
Well, Dean, we got to take a quick commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Dean Butler. Dean, before we went to commercial break, you were telling us how you moved from Philadelphia to Monmouth Park, and tell us what you found when you got there.
Well, I got there, and I just got done in Philadelphia, did really well in Philadelphia with the bug, and decided, well, I'm going to go to Monmouth Park and try it out and see what I can do over there. I had a nice house on the beach and right in Seabright, and I was gonna enjoy it. And if I did good, I did good. If I didn't, I didn't. I'd go back to Philadelphia, you know. But I was very fortunate, and I rode a lot of races and for a lot of people, but the majority of the races was for Jimmy Crupie, and I did really well, and I ended up finishing ninth in the standings there, actually just after losing the bug.
It's pretty impressive, Dean. And living on the beach, you can't beat that, right?
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Where did you go that winter?
Then I think I went back. Then I started going down to Gulfstream in Florida. And I did well enough between Monmouth and the Meadowlands. And then I'd go to Gulfstream in the wintertime and basically hang out and be warm. And two of my good friends that we used to always hang out were Tommy Turner and Dale Beckner.
Oh, yeah. And how did you like, did you ride a lot of Gulfstream?
No, not a lot. I rode probably... It varied. I mean, there's some weeks I'd ride, you know, four or five, and then there were other weeks I'd ride 10, you know. I mean, you know, but it was tough. It was slow, but, you know, I was fortunate enough to where I did well enough during the summertime and the fall. You know, I could, you know, go down there and, you know, and I'd breeze horses for a lot of people, you know, Nick Zito and all that, you know, just because they were good horses and easy to breeze.
Well, indeed, eventually you decided to move your tack to Kentucky later on. Why did you decide to go there?
I kind of had enough of the East Coast, of the traveling, you know, because when you're, at Monmouth, Philadelphia, you know, I was going crazy. I was driving from Philadelphia to Monmouth and Meadowlands and Delaware, and it was just getting old, and I wanted to try something different, try, you know, moving up and going, figured, well, let's go to Kentucky, see what I can do.
Yeah, that Mid-Atlantic circuit, so many racetracks in close proximity. Yeah. You're on the road all the time, riding day and night, which is good.
Exactly. I mean, when I was up there, I used to put at least 30,000 miles a year on my car.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah.
You should have your agent drive you around.
and that was the thing. I always drove myself because never really, you know, I was never one that could sleep when somebody else was driving, you know, and I just was more comfortable driving myself, you know, it was just a lot easier.
So where did you start at in Kentucky? Were you at Churchill or Keeneland or?
I had gotten there right at the end of Churchill, right after the Derby, and right before they went to Ellis Park. And I did pretty good at Ellis Park the first year I was there. And then, of course, then went to Turfway and did really well at Turfway. And then Keeneland, of course, then it kind of slowed down a little bit at Keeneland, and then back to Churchill. And then back to Turfway. I mean, I always did well, really well at, you know, Turfway and Ellis Park, you know, when the bigger riders, the quote-unquote better riders came in, you know, for Keeneland and Churchill, you know, then my business would kind of back down a little bit, you know. I would still do well and I'd still win races, but, I didn't have the name yet for there.
Well, then you got that name when you decided to then go up to Canterbury. So you completely, you perfectly described the name Gypsy. Well, that applies to you for sure, as many places you traveled to. But you decided to go to Canterbury, and you just took off when you decided to go there.
Yeah, I've done very well there. I mean, I've been there 10 years, and I've been leading rider 5 of the 10 years that I've been there. And done very well, and it was the last 3 years, well, excluding this last summer when I got hurt, I had broken the record for amount of money won, you know, in a single meet for the track, and then I came back the next year and broke my own record, and then came back the following year and broke it again, so for basically the last 3 years, I had, you know, broken the record for the amount of money won via jockey at Canterbury.
That's impressive, Dean. That's very impressive. Mm-hmm. And then you would winter in Tampa, which I also rode down there. And you mentioned going south for the winter. It's definitely nice to stay warm versus riding up where it's cold. So, And Tampa's
it's tough. I mean, it's tough. It's tough down here because there's a lot of riders. And, you know, Tampa's the type of place that, you know, I always say you can, the first 2 weeks here, you could win 20 races. And that might be the only 20 races you win the rest of the winter. You know, it's not going to change, you know, the people, you know, looking at you, you know, coming in and say, oh, who's this jock? You know, because most places when a new rider comes in and he starts doing really well, usually he takes off and he rides for everybody. Tampa is very funny. The people, the trainer colony down here, they ride who they ride, you know, and it's very tough. You know, I mean, down here I ride for all little trainers, you know, I mean, none of them are really in the top 10, you know, in the standings, you know. I mean, I might ride a horse here or there for Jerry Bennett, but for the most part, I don't ride for the top 10 trainers, you know. I ride for all the little guys. And, you know, and actually it's kind of more gratifying when I win because they appreciate it more, you know, and it's, you know, and it's, should I say, quote unquote, a little harder, you know, to be able to win those kind of races because, you know, for those people, because they don't have the caliber of horses that, you know, the Jerry Bennett, you know, Mike Stidham and, you know, Delacour has, you know, what they have is what they have.
Well, Dean, you won your 2000th race at Tampa in 2016. And what was that milestone like when you crossed the wire in front, knowing that was that big number, number 2000?
Well, I can tell you it was the best thing in the world because I had the people that I loved so much right there with me. My dad was there. I mean, he's been my biggest fan my whole riding career, you know, and it was an honor to have him there. And my brother, it was funny, my brother that was here, the first time he ever come to races, it was when I got one of the leading rider trophies at Philadelphia Park. And I was on 6 horses that day, and 5 of them win, and the other one runs second.
Wow.
So
he's good luck.
whenever he showed up, I always won a race. It was amazing. You know, I mean, when he'd come to town, I won races. I was on the streak, you know, not last year, the year before, and I wasn't winning anything. I couldn't win a race. The very first day he showed up, I win 2 races that day, you know.
Wow.
So, you know, it's just, you know, and it's just, it's, but it's always been like that. And then, of course, then I was, I had my girlfriend Danielle, she was here, you know, and that's, you know, so.
Had to be just an incredible moment for you.
Made it special, you know.
Jockey Dean Butler joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Dean, I want to talk about a pretty nice horse you used to ride, Poor But Honest. Tell us how you got the mount, and tell us about all the success you guys had together.
He was an amazing horse. He was a horse that I won my very first stake on. It was at Garden State Park, and I rode a lot for Juan Soray, and Juan Soray and me, I mean, we won tons of races together, and that horse there, I remember he brought the horse over, and actually, I didn't ride him the very first time. Tommy Turner had ridden him at the Meadowlands, and the horse was running in New York. He was, you know, he was fast, he was speed, and he would run for 3/4 of a mile because he ran long, and he would stop, you know, and that was before New York had Lasix, so they shipped him over to New Jersey and where they had Lasix, and they got him on Lasix, and the Lasix had helped him a lot. And then I started getting on him, and I win my very first stake on the Trenton Handicap at Garden State Park. I beat that horse Benny Perkins Senior conveyor. And it was funny. One morning, me and Chucky Lopez were in the gate, and I was working, poor but honest, I was only working them 3/8 of a mile, and he was on conveyor, and he was working 5/8 of a mile. And Chucky looked at me, and he says, "I'm on a pretty fast horse, Dino." He goes, "You know," I said, "Yeah." I said, "Mine's pretty fast, Chucky." I said, "I'm going 3/8." I said, "Don't worry, I'll stay out. I won't get you dirty." I said, "You know," but so basically the favorite and my horse ended up going off, I don't know, 15-1 that morning. We're in the gate about a week before the race. And when we left there, I left there and I sent my horse right away from there and in the morning. And Chucky worked his horse. And I actually galloped out faster than he worked 5/8 of a mile. And he asked me, he goes, "Who was that you were on?" I said, "Don't worry." I said, "He's the one you got to beat in the stakes, you know, on the Trenton handicap." He goes, "Holy cow." Well, then the night of the handicap, I ended up beating him, you know, about a half a length, 3/4 of a length. And my horse was on the lead all the way and come to me, and he just rebroke and took off again.
Wow. Yeah.
But
yeah.
Then I had gone down and we went to Maryland and I went a race in Laurel and it was a grade two. And then we went to Pimlico and the same thing, went a grade two there. And then I was second in the Island to a horse named Shawsburg. And then I was second in the Mass Cap to Cigar. Hmm. And then I was second in the Meadowlands Cup to a horse named Peaks and Valleys.
Oh, yes. Well, he always tried that horse, my gosh. And
he had a huge heart. And if he got on the lead and you were able to, and he was able to switch his lead, turn it for home, he was very tough to get by. And he would dog a horse. He would, you know, he would battle. And he was an honest running little horse.
What was it like in the Mass Cap, running against Cigar? Can you just give us a brief description of how that race went?
Well, I can tell you, when we broke from the gate, and my horse had speed, and of course, and being my experience of riding that in Boston, the track was kind of deep on the outside. When I went to the lead, what I did was I kind of drifted out, and I sat in like the four path. And Cigar was, and then Eddie Maple was still riding then, and he was on a horse for John Pregman. I can't remember the horse's name, but then Bailey was on Cigar. Well, I was on the lead about four wide, and right before the track gets real sandy, you know, about the 5/6 path, it gets real sandy and deep. And so basically what I was doing, I was floating him out there to keep him out there to make him work a little harder because I knew he was out. I could see him out there. And Bailey knew it. He knew what I was doing. And he realized it. And he kind of had to get after Cigar. And I think that might have been one of the first times he actually hit Cigar to, you know, get him running. And Bailey, when we got back to the jock's room, he said to me, he goes, "Man, you had me nervous." I said, "Yeah." I said, "My little horse dug in hard." I said, "Then the class kicked in, you know." I said, "You know," about the eighth hole, and then he kind of drew away from me, you know, the last part of it. But I couldn't, I mean, it was probably 6 or 7 back to the third horse, you know.
Wow.
So it was basically a somewhat of a two-horse race for the most part. But, yeah, it was an honor to run second to him, you know. I mean, yeah, of course, I would have liked to have been the one to beat him. But,
guys,
you know, to take that record away, you know. But, you know, little horse run hard and he come back good. So that's all that mattered to me.
Well, and had to be an even better feeling when you won your first graded stakes aboard Poor But Honest. And that had to be an incredible feeling.
Oh, yeah. You know, especially, you know, the little horse that, you know, had been running for cheap money, you know, and, you know, everybody never really gave him any recognition, you know. But, yeah, I mean, he had earned $460,000. The time that I was, for the whole time that I had ridden, you know. So, you know, he's made a pretty good dollar, and he, like I said, he was an honest little horse. He was as honest as they came.
I'm guessing he's probably your favorite horse you've ridden, or does someone else take that title?
Probably he's one of my, yeah, he's right there. I mean, probably the horse that I win my 2000 race on is probably my favorite. You know, I mean, he's a good little horse. I love, you know, that horse, you know, I know that horse, he runs good for me, you know, a horse called Impromptu. And of course, then it's the Milestone of, you know, winning 2000 races. There's not too many jockeys that do that.
What was that horse like to ride Impromptu, and what success did you find together other than winning your 2003?
Yeah, he's a great, you know, and the owners that I ride for that own him, they're really great people. But that horse there, he's just an honest horse, you know, and you know, I mean, as far as, you know, just when you get on a horse, you know, you just kind of mesh together with a horse, you know. I mean, there's horses that I'm sure you've ridden before that you just get on and they run for you, you know, and not that they don't run for anybody else, but they run differently for you, you know, because you get along so well with them, or you know them, or, you know, you can feel them underneath, you know, you become part of them, should I say.
Definitely true, Dean. And so before you're getting ready to go out to the track, say you're about to ride Impromptu or Poor But Honest or one of these nice horses, or any horse really, what do you do to get pumped up before a race? Do you handicap the race the night before, or do you watch replays, or what do you do right before a race?
Usually I'll watch, you know, like if I haven't ridden a horse before, I'll watch a replay of it. And then of course I always handicap the day of the race and right before the races, just so I don't, you know, miss anything or forget anything. You know, but you know, I mean, if you've been riding the horse a lot, you know the horse, of course. But you try and figure out where everybody else wants to be, where their horses want to be. And sometimes, you know, you can handicap the horse, but then you also have to handicap the rider, you know. If you have a rider that likes to show speed and lay close, you know, usually that's his style of riding, and he's on a horse that comes from behind. Well, naturally, he's probably going to have that horse in the race a little bit more if he can, you know. Chucky Lopez is a perfect example. Chucky loves to be on the lead. He loves, you know, and if he has a horse that comes from out of it, usually if they're not on the lead, they're pretty close to it. So that's going to change the way that horse is going to run, or, you know, he might run better, he might not run, you know, but it depends on how the style of the jock, you know, how the jock rides.
Would you say that's more difficult at Tampa right now, where there are so many riders coming from so many different places and a lot of young riders as well? Would you say that's probably has to be more difficult?
Yeah, exactly. When you come to a meet like Tampa and that's the case, it's, you know, now, like when I go to Canterbury, a lot of times it's the same riders that go there every year. So, yeah, of course, I get to know them. And I get to know their habits, you know. I can, you know, like I was explaining with Tony Black, you know, the way he, you know, he herded around the racetrack, you know. I mean, he would, you know, float riders out and then, you know, come in or whatever and coax you into a spot, you know. You get to know the riders like that. But when you come to a meet like Tampa, where there's riders coming from everywhere and you haven't really paid attention to where that rider, you might not even know where he's been riding, you know? So then you kind of got to get used to, or get to know them as far as, you know, what their habits are.
Dean, I was an apprentice at Tampa, and it really was a good spot for me to start riding, because there were so many great older riders who gave me good advice. And when a young rider comes to a track that you're riding at, do you try to help them out and take them under your wing a little bit and give them guidance, knowing that you're out there with them and you want them to be safe?
Of course, you always try and do that. Sometimes it's hard to do that. Sometimes it's hard to, you know, the rider comes in, and especially if he starts doing good, he gets a little cocky and he gets, you know, he thinks he knows everything. And sometimes you can sit him down and you can talk to him. But sometimes you can't, you know, and sometimes you got to take him, you know, go out on the racetrack and school them a little bit, should I say, make them, put them in a little tight or something like that, or whatever, or race ride them a little bit, because you have the experience of doing that, to be able to do that, should I say. But yeah, I mean, if a rider is willing to learn, there's not a rider around that I know of that wouldn't help somebody. That's like when I came around, I didn't talk back. I didn't, and if I did something in a race, I would let that rider, if I bothered somebody, and of course, they get mad, they yell and scream at you, and I just, okay, I'm sorry, and then walk away. And then later on that day, when they're cooled off, I'd go to them and say, okay, tell me, what should I have done differently, because then that way you learn. And then you also, the best thing to do is, I learned a lot by just watching, watching the older riders. I picked out Tony Black and Joe Hampshire, and I watched them, and just, you learn so much just by watching.
So now let me ask you, what advice would you give to a young person who wants to become a rider?
Learn as much as you can, and when you think you're ready, go back and learn more.
Yeah.
And like I said, if you can learn from the bottom up and learn more about a horse, versus just jumping on a horse and riding, it'll help you immensely in the end.
Dean, we only have a couple minutes left, a couple more questions I want to ask you. What are your, what's on your bucket list, career-wise and otherwise?
I'm getting older, of course, and I have two little girls. So they're my main aspect right now, and of course, riding wise, and I just want to, do the best I can for the remainder of time that I am going to ride, and then basically mainly do something else, as I get older. My body's in pretty good shape right now, and I feel really good. So, who knows how long I can ride for. And I'm the type of person that as long as I'm doing okay and still winning and all that, just like anybody, you don't get down on yourself, and you're going to go through slumps and you're not going to win races and all that. But when it kind of seems like, okay, it's time for me to, try something else, that's when I'll try something else.
How old are you, Dean?
I'm 46.
You've got many years left in the saddle, but what do you think, maybe will you stay in the industry when that time does come, far in the future? What do you think you'll do?
Honestly, probably not. I'll probably do something else. I'll probably actually get away from it. The industry is, good right now, but it's not like it was when I first started.
So we'll see you doing something else long in the future, Dean. And tell me also, we haven't talked about this yet, but I know I struggled with this a lot when I rode. I'm tall, and the weight was very difficult for me. What do you do to keep your weight down, and what's your daily diet when you're riding?
Actually, I'm one of the very fortunate ones that I can basically eat whatever I want. And the heaviest I've ever been in my whole life is 112 pounds. And so, but I usually range between 108 and 109 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm 5'2", 5'2 and a half or whatever. So I've always been very light. I've never had a fight. I've never had a weight issue never had a reduce of any kind. I think one time when I had the bug and I had to do 106 or 105 or something like that, and I couldn't eat breakfast that morning. But basically, I can eat before I go in the room, and I don't have any problems.
I'm jealous, Dean. I'm jealous.
Yeah.
I remember One of my friends, she'd come in the jocks room and she'd sit down on the couch and she'd be eating this sandwich, and I hadn't eaten in 3 days and I hated it. Not fun. Yep. Not fun. But do you, besides working horses in the morning, of course, do you go to the gym at all? Do you work out in yep. addition to yeah. horses?
Yeah, I do. I've been going to the gym a lot, you know, and I do the Stairmaster. And I'll tell you what, that's the greatest thing in the world because it does a lot of cardio and it gets your air and it builds your air up.
Would you say, obviously, riders, they use every single muscle in their body, but would you say legs is probably the most important to focus on?
Legs and strengthening your back up. You know, I mean, that's what I've come to, you know, find is strengthen my back up and my legs, of course. And then basically your upper body, you know, like your chest and your upper arms and all that. I think it's all equivalent, you know, as far as what you're using, you know, and as far as your, you know, you use a lot of totally different muscles, you know. You can go to the gym and lift weights and run on the Stairmaster and do the Stairmaster and, you know, do all this kind of stuff, and jog and all that. But, you know, just like anything, you use different muscles when you're on horses.
Well, Dean, we are all out of time. Thank you so much for joining us tonight and wishing you all the best in the future and there at Tampa.
Great. Thank you. It was an honor.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website. That's horseracingradio.net. While you're there, check out all of the other great shows you can find on the Horse Racing Radio Network, like Trainer Talk, Equine Forum, and, of course, Express Bet Radio. Join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Dallapina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.